5 years of Vampire the Masquerade presents Vampire the Requiem.
Hey folks, DJ here. I just want to take some time to talk about Werewolf the Apocalypse Retaliations by Flyles Games. This soon-to-launch game is brought to you by the same team that's bringing you Vampire the Masquerade Chapters, and they just released a trailer to go along with it. We at 25 invite you to check it out at werewolftheapocalypse-retaliation.com to catch a peek at the trailer and be updated of when it'll appear on Kickstarter, which seems to be early 2022. The game promises to have everything that made Chapters endearing to us, the fans, including scenarios, investigations, beautiful miniatures, and more. With that, thanks for your time.
Well, welcome everybody to 25 Years Vampire the Masquerade Presents Requiem. And to slam dunk it off the bat, you know, I'm with my two compadres, my compadros, my brojachos, as it said. Of course, we got Brennan.
What's up, everyone?
And we got Chris, a.k.a. DJ, a.k.a. Devil Monkey of the East Coast. And no, I didn't call Brunch from the Black Dragon. It turns out it's a secret. So,
okay.
That being the case, we're just going to keep going. Folks, this has been a gem of a book that we're going over today, and that book is, of course, I believe it's Bloodlines, pronounce it. Bloodlines.
The Legendary.
The Legendary. And what's cool about this book is that, first off, let's talk how Requiem is better. Because there is something to say here. We've been reviewing a lot of books, like every book they have on Vampire up to this point. And this is even over a lot of the V5 content, in my opinion, that was kicked through, right? You may be wondering, Bob, ooh, dangerous. No, let's talk about what they did right in Requiem, right? And the fact is that you have an intro story that seems to be classic, what you need there. But most importantly, it's like they wrote this to speak to you, the fan, you, the purchaser of this book, to say, hey, just so you know, we listened to feedback from the Bloodlines of the Hidden that came out before this, and it was good. Mm-hmm. And in the spirit of constructive criticism, we realized that you'd like to see a little more about each bloodline. While this means numerically fewer bloodlines per book, and that's why you're not going to see as many in here, it does mean a 50% increase to talk about what they are, more information on them, how you might use them, their legends, right? Hence the legendary. And they pitched that through. I loved reading that, but I also hated reading that, because then what am I for? What are we for? Mm. Right, if we're reading this book and we're trying to tell people what's in, it's like you don't need us because it's right here, you know. And but it's refreshing too, because one thing you could do as a reviewer is you can think you're correct and go off in a direction and not line up with the author, right, at all, like because you understand what they're doing. But it's useful in case you don't agree with how they made the book, right? I enjoy that. It's like here's your standing argument. Do your worst. Right, is what they did throwing out there. Except with this, of course, I know we're supporters of it, 100%.
There's no doubt.
Now, the theme among Bloodlines, the legendary they talk about is that each is, it's somehow known in some capacity, whether by a local domain or a local occult seeker or vampire or just a human who's a specialist. These guys exist in legend. These bloodlines. People have heard about it because they have some pretty garish behavior, even by vampire standards, mm-hmm. as to what they are and what they represent. And what we're going to do is we're going to take turns here kind of highlighting that by kicking through all of them in a synopsis and maybe digging deep on a few, just to wet the whistle. And we're going to talk about those few a little bit more in depth. But to start this off, can you tell us what the... I'm just stumbling over myself... their bloodline legend, the first one they have up, is called the Braun. What are these guys?
I'll take that one. So the Braun are a Ventru-based clan, or at least their parent clan was Ventru-based. And what ends up happening is it's a tale about the questing knight. It's about that Holy Grail in general. And the great part about it is that it's not only written in a specific fashion where you're thinking to yourself, oh, Arthurian legend, Avalon, let's talk about getting to the Holy Grail itself. It breaks off in two separate parts. The reason I say that is because it covers both a Lankea version of it, where you take a look at it from a Christian perspective. Let's get that Holy Grail. Who drank from this cup? Why is someone cursed the way that they are specifically? And why are they called the quote-unquote questing knight from it? Which I'll explain to you when we get to our weaknesses. The other one is it takes off of Celtic legend when it speaks about Bran the Blessed. Wait, so how do you get both of those together in the same spot and put them under the questing knight? Interesting story. So let me start off with their weakness to begin with. and this will probably clear it up, and this is where we could explore it more. This particular weakness that this bloodline has is wherever they are, wherever they choose to rest their heads, they can't stay there for long because the land will turn against them. Which is, in and of itself, wonky and amazing.
So they just...
Bob, I see you have that expression. Hit me with that.
Yeah, now you hit me with that. See, I am not the one who has to explain or defend that, sir. You're quarterbacking this? I read that and I was like, okay, I want to hear other opinions to it, right?
So, okay, DJ, so the, is it...
Go ahead, Bob.
Is it like they have to continually keep moving, or can they like stay... If someone offers them shelter, can they stay there, or is it like, no, they're almost like a homeless knight?
Great distinction. Actually, it's whatever they consider their domain. So if they're laying their head somewhere, technically it's not theirs. They're just kind of resting their head. But the moment they claim something as theirs, even if it's just a city block, even if it's just a tenement building that they call their own, the land eventually just turns against them. If they're trying to feed, they make it that much harder because for whatever reason, as luck would have it, anytime he wants to go feed or she wants to go feed, their prey is always surrounded in ambient light, or they're in a group. Anytime they're trying to probably run away from something, what should be a simple chain link fence ends up becoming an obstacle for them. So it ends up becoming an issue. And as I guess as I talk about it, right, how this ties in, the reason why is because in legend and the way that it's tying into these grand scheme of legends are those that have drank from the cup were cursed. And the land, of course, revolts against them the same way that Sir Galahad had issues, or the same way Lancelot had issues, or Arthurian legend where something.
Well, let's pump the brakes. Some of us are youngins, right? Some of us never sat in a library bored. We had Google and YouTube, and we didn't look up an Arthurian legend, so we didn't have that cool point in our childhood to really enjoy a story, or later on in life happened to come across it beyond a movie. So, and we know that there's really no explanation. What is the curse of Galahad there that you're talking about?
Well, the curse in the way they have it written, especially from a Lankea standpoint, essentially, is as they drank, or rather the person who did end up becoming the founder drank from the Holy Grail, or what was considered the Holy Grail, it was not meant for them. It was not meant for them, and doing so, what it did was it poisoned back land, at least from the perspective of the person who levied it on them. And this is all, once again, myth and legend. But you say to yourself, wait, can't God could be the only one, or isn't the creator? No, this is where it's all... allegorical, right? So the allegory behind that is they drank from something they shouldn't, at least from the Lankea portion of it, and in return, because you have defiled yourself further from what you're supposed to be to stand up with in the perception of God, this is the issue. What makes it interesting is, especially from the Lankea portion of it, you take a look that this is also, once again, that quest. You want to make things right with your maker. From the spear point of view, you're doing your job by being that damned and making sure that mortals understand specifically what they should be respecting. But from yourself, it's the seeking of perfection, the seeking of finding yourself back into grace. And until that happens, you will always have to be on the move. Otherwise, you'll be heavily reminded of what it is that you are.
All right.
The others. Go ahead.
Oh, no. You were going into the other. I thought I had my classic pause. Please go.
No. Yeah, the other side of it is definitely the Celtic King part, where we have Bran the Blessed, who had fought a Welsh king who had expanded his land and had found out that, unfortunately, his poor sister was being treated illy by an Irish king. He goes to wreck shop over there. They try to hold him back, and when they attempt to do so, he just wrecks them. Kills most of them, and then they go, we need to do something to stop this guy. So they find a witch, get a cauldron, and they attempt to poison him. And in the process of doing so, they halfway succeed. What ends up happening is it backfires, and Bran, rather than dying, he ends up becoming undead. And during that period in time, he wipes out all those who oppose him. But because he's no longer living and is rather undead, he could no longer connect to the land. And because he could no longer connect to the land, that's where the curse comes from his particular end.
But he built a wall in the north to stop the whites from getting across, eventually to destroy the rest of the kingdom?
I mean, this is a common story, right?
It's Bran the Builder is what I couldn't get out of my head ever since I saw that. And I was like,
you're not wrong, but there's similarities to it, right? Because that's exactly what ends up happening is eventually the myth goes, he had his head cut off. He had his head wake up and go, burn my body, take my head, bring it elsewhere, and tell my remnants that, you know, my descendants, only the living should take care of the living.
Hey, that's pretty badass. I'll be honest with that. I'm going to leave that there. I think that's a perfect cliffhanger Folks, you heard him correctly. This guy had his head cut off and he said, hey, I did what I could. Send my head to the descendants for wisdom. And that's the legend, right? That's what's there for it. Bran lives on. Somewhere, he is the head in the Lovecraft-inspired story, The Head in the Jar, right? The Bran in the Jar type thing. But no, I'm not even making fun of the author there. I think that's something so cool that if I were in a campaign for Requiem and heard about it, I would want to seek out somebody who might have been a part of that. And to easily, you could see how Order Dracul would be interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You defy destruction. How? Right? What's it like being just a vampiric head? If that's the case, like, that's an interesting in to have if it's even true. What if it's not true? Like, you say they drinking from the Grail and some elder. What if? Because, you know, Christianity and whatnot, they're immortal. Naturally, they predate those religions. It's just a tool. That's the, you know, this is another blood cult that started, you know, like they knew their pitch of some ancient evil cult that worked back in the day and when the skies rain blood, but they switched that over to meet the onslaught of the Christian army coming, and they learn it well, and they're like, hey, we got this relic. You know, Jesus drank from it. You have it? Yeah, I got it right here. You want to drink from it? Want to taste the glory? You know, or however they said it, and like, really, it's corrupting, right? We don't know. Well, why would it be corrupting? Well, you're a vampire now, stupid. All right, that's the thing. Like, what goes on there? There's tons of story content with it, and that's one of the things I think the authors did very, very well, is that there's enough. We use this term wonky or wonk. Once again, we'll define it. That's when your brain goes, there's a logic you have when someone says, pretend that vampire is just a world of darkness, right? The dark reflection of the real world to a gothic punk feel where evil is around every corner and it's always to the worst possible it could be with dystopian corporations, et cetera, et cetera. We all get that. However, wonk is when somehow someone smashes your idea of what logic is. Right?
It's something so far out of left field that your suspension of disbelief can no longer hold.
Yeah, it just goes out the window.
If you're not with me, when I read this, it was one thing, right? I'm going through it all, taking my notes and whatever, and I just like, yeah, it's a legend, no big deal. The way DJ just pitched it was like, oh, it's awesome, Brandon Builder, he's ahead. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. I literally forgot about that because this didn't grab me. The artwork grabbed me,
mm-hmm.
Right? If you're a fan of Kingdom of Heaven, the artwork here looks great, right? Of that movie, just the feel of it. I feel like someone got a hold of that and was inspired. Or, since I'm pretty sure this predates that film, I don't know, actually. I didn't look it up. But I kind of feel that, you know, this book, we'll just assume the artists are unique. And it's tons and tons of photos one could do. And the ones they chose are grip me good. Right in a good spot, right? Or as Alex Jones would say, right in the executive crotch parts. That's where it is. So you got to be an Alex Jones fan to get that. Dude's nuts, but I mean he's funny to listen to in a lot of reasons. Is that comment right there? So moving on though, that was just one of these guys, right? The next one. Now why are we dead ending it? Because we could kill a podcast trying to talk about that alone. Mm-hmm. And how many ways and what were they thinking or what were they smoking? Right. I'm on the more smoke side of things because how would you put that in? But then I sat there and said to myself, I could play like Lancelot. Or a cool knight crusading to be in the name of my creator, to keep that humanity, all that stuff. That could be a lot of fun. But then, you know, the night courts, the others, how am I going to get along with them? You know, walk around carrying a broadsword, dueling things in the ocean in the morning? Like, what are you doing? So, who knows? Who knows? But it could be fun to figure that out. But let's get something more darker. They have in here a bloodline called the Carnival, Brennan. What is this?
So the Carnival are, well, they're showmen, right? They're macabre. Like, I want you to think of some of the worst horror stories you've heard of that featured like carnivals, and they typify everything, right? I think the most recent one you would have remembered would be American Horror Story. I don't know if you're an American Horror Story fan. I think you are. I know I am. So it's,
I've seen that.
It's straight up in that vein. To go over their history real quick. There was a woman who was born with like her legs fused together. Besides that, she was actually a pretty like attractive and like normal woman, right? But because of that, she handicap in life. She was taken care of for most of her life, but as time goes on, her caretakers were much more abusive, much more resentful, until they finally decided to just sell her off so they could make something of her. And her time, what they sold her off to was the circus. right? As you can imagine, right? There's a theme here, and that's where that theme kind of really picks up. And while she was at the circus, she was, well, you can imagine the abuse that would have been heaped on someone in that situation, someone that can't defend themselves, someone that is exploited to make money, because she was by far the most popular attraction to that carnival. Everyone who went there to see her. And it was one night where the, he wasn't the owner of it, but he was the ringleader of the carnival, was, I will say, making her earn her keep, as it were, that the a specific vampire comes across them. Someone that's, well, he was someone that was also abused.
You seem like you're having discomfort at that point, describing
this is a very dark
keep. So I'm going to free you. I'm going to free you, right? Because I feel we should do this, right? Our audience may not have been signing up to read this and hear all that, right? If it's making you uncomfortable, and you are my bro chacho when it comes to horror film fandom, maybe, just maybe, we'll not be part of the Bilderberg group here, and we'll put a pin in it.
Okay.
Right? Let's not be the lizard people and disclose all secrets and talk about their long-lost child, which is what she sounds like. That's why she was born with her legs fused together.
Mm-hmm.
That serpent DNA coming down from on high, as they say, as they look into our souls and know the future. That's more Alex Jones speech for me saying we're just going to move on from that story, displaying it in that depth. What we can say, and come with me on this, when you say that they're like American Horror Story, do you get why they chose a carnival bloodline? Like, did you, what are your thoughts on that? Why do you think, how does this relate to the vampire mythos?
This, why they chose this specific theme, because we talked about this originally with bloodlines, right? Whenever a bloodline is founded, it is founded by a vampire, or a specific vampire, and it's not always, well, actually rarely intentional. It is from that point forward, their vitae can overwrite, or is so strong that it imprints basically a part of themselves onto those that come later, whether it's an embrace or their quote-unquote avist in, right? This woman was a performer more than anything else, someone who did put on a show. And as her time as a vampire, she used her abilities to the fullest extent of it. She knew her lot in life, and she took every advantage that she possibly could, draining blood, money, influence, everything she could as her carnival, because it was hers at that point, traveled along. And as she traveled along, she made more and more children. And as that went on, she found they took on other deformities. Right.
But you're explaining, but what you're doing is you're going back to the well to explain their construction. What I'm saying is the concept of the carnival, the bloodline itself, right? I'll give my opinion real quick, right? I think the same reason American Horror Story told it, the same way clowns scare the shit out of people, the same way It is such a success and so terrifying to people, is because the idea of a traveling carnival of strangers that can hide themselves behind paint, that can do fantastical, strange, seemingly weird things. This terrifies you because you can't put a name to it. You can't name them like Hollywood stars.
Yeah, and it's also fascinating, right? It's why people flock to these things, to see these shows, to see these performances. It is to see something that's both awesome and like an old like meaning of it, right? It makes you feel full of like awe, and also it's grotesque. It's makes you reviled, but it's something you can't turn away from. That's what this bloodline lives for. What I loved about these guys is they're brutally kind of honest. They don't go around trying to get influence in all these different cities. They don't try to own domain. They go out so that they can perform.
Right. And they go out to perform because if they sit somewhere and become a domain, they're less potent. Right. They're not as fearful. They don't have that. I mean, think about it. If a traveling carnival comes to town, I don't know if you know this, but there used to be a craze back in the late 70s or the early 70s, late 60s about warnings of traveling carnivals and people going there alone at night and things like that. And it's a lot of it is just because, you know, there's a bad egg in every crop, right? Some terrible things happened a long time ago, you know, and things get blamed on where that happens. I remember being at the circus, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, a ridiculously long name around here. We were going to the circus. It was a great thing. But it's okay to go to a circus. But what's in a circus? Elephants, clowns, trapeze artists, cotton candy apples. Okay. What's at a carnival? Clowns, If you're lucky, they have a tent big enough to do a trapeze show. Elephants, if they're large enough for that, you know, I mean, they could be the same stuff could be there. Mm-hmm. It just depends on how successful that carnival is. But the difference is a carnival has the option to up and leave. It could be up and gone. They don't have to stay there as long and or announce their presence and they're up and out. That ability to just be there and disappear. Think about it. Would you let your child go at night with just their group of friends to go run to the local carnival if there was an ad, or not an ad, something you saw in the paper that said, you know, missing children, four missing last weekend, last seen going out past curfew?
Mm-mm. Not at all.
Parents last saw them at the mall, but, you know, turns out when you look at it, the mall is just but a few miles from the carnival.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who do you think is getting the blame there? Who is the police going to stop? You see what I'm saying? Now, this is great for a vampire to be a member of this carnival, right? Even the idea, the conception, I applaud it because it preys on our fear and it gives a definite reason to be afraid, right? That these folks are here. Now, to talk a little bit unique, they have a discipline too. And the discipline is incredibly normal. I'm going to say that it's bland because it's what you would expect at a carnival. Right, it's what you expect that, right? They have a contortionist one, or one where they can make their bones incredibly malleable, like rubber, to mm-hmm. fit through any tiny open. You know, it's like the vampiric form of weird and cool. You know, spider sticking and walking across surfaces to be even more unnerving. And I said to myself, that's pretty awesome they did that, because the focus is still on the concept, and the discipline is but a tool mm-hmm. to hammer home what they are—the theme. So in my opinion, it's well done. You guys share that opinion? Do you think they could have done better, or would you push it a little farther?
No,
you know, it's funny because on my end, I actually saw this from a different angle, whereas we could look at it from, you know, the horror aspect. I actually took a look at it from a Requiem aspect, which is one of the key things we always speak about Requiem is the reason why you still exist and the reason why you allow yourself to be caged with other animals is because you need them to verify your existence. So when you're taking a look at these carnies, these freak show people, right, in terms of how, you know, we view them from the outside, they're family. They use each other to stay within their own Requiem. And within their family, this is what they anticipate, this is what they accept, and this is why they're so successful and a threat to other domains is because they work as a unit. They don't have to worry as often about having to deal with other predators from different covenants or clans. It's literally just one. And the price of admission is what we haven't spoken about, which is their weakness. They're actually a Deva clan. Meaning, you know, there's that lust for life. There's a lust for action and passion and such. However, upon embrace, eventually, they start earning. They start having their bodies deformed in one shape or another to match that. So they give up a portion of what they originally were in order to fit the family, in order to understand, like, you know, missing limb, scales, no hair, all hair, whatever the case might be. That's the price of admission for family. And I think that's what caught me the most out of it was when you take a look at other social structures or other covenants or bloodlines that we'll, you know, see in the future, what stood this one out is it's unique because it's of circumstance. This could have happened anywhere else. This could have happened amongst hobos. This could have happened amongst aristocracy. This could have happened amongst people in a Catholic school, whatever the case is, right? But it happened to be a carnival. And I think because of it, it only strikes more the family aspect of why people keep others around during the record.
Well, I mean, the key point about that is that there is something they have to do to belong, right? Sacrifice mm-hmm. is what we're talking about.
Yep.
That's a very fraternity-esque price of admission, if you ask me. It's what cults do.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just join. You got to prove you want to be here. And then there's something you got to do. I like it. I think anyone should really have an entry-level thing like that when they want to do it. But to me, that just makes the carnival more creepy. Right? To join you, I got to have a receding hairline. Why? Right? Because, you know, we don't have one of those. Yeah. You need to be a good geek. You need to have a receding hairline. Why? Just creepy. Yeah, okay. We'll move on. You know, thanks. I don't want to join the carnival. Are you sure? We have candy. You know, I don't know what the pitch would be like, but, you know, something in there. They're cool. That's all I'm getting at. Why? Because they give me the heebie-jeebies, so I give them a thumbs up.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have enough heebie-jeebies in my life. All right. So, rolling on from there, we have the Children of Judas. Now, off the bat, I'm going to tell you, anything relating to Judas is going to draw my attention because a lot of folks don't know this. There's legends that came up about Judas, from what he did in the Bible, right? Mm-hmm. Care to elaborate what that Judas story is, either one of you? Just want to make sure I'm dealing with peers here.
Yeah, no, no. The basics of it essentially is Judas the betrayer, Judas Iscariot. What makes his claim to fame was he was one of the apostles, and at one point his mind, his will, for whatever reason, and how he interpreted how he's going to go about his life was to say he was going to betray Jesus. 30 pieces of silver, and he sold the man out by giving him a kiss. And at that moment in time, when Jesus was marked, Judas felt some type of way about his actions, grabbed a rope, left his 30 pieces behind, and hung himself. And if there is a special place in hell, it's reserved for that gentleman, if legend is to be told.
And I debate this to... I'm going to tell you right now what I was kicked out of... No joke. I was kicked out of a...
Can I stop you right there? Because I think we're going to go down the same way. Is it that if Judas didn't do what he did, then there wouldn't be a whole like Christianity thing? Because that's the whole freaking point? Okay,
no,
never mind.
It's not that at all. The point of... Well, I mean, you can go that route. But what I said was, is that I remember being Catholic Church, and I was going through the process of conversion. You got to go to school and do all that. And it was for adults. I was very combative about some of the points, and this one was hard for me, because what I saw was Judas didn't know Jesus was anything, the same as anybody else, right? Where he was at, he was going through life doing his thing. However, when he made a deal and they offered him 30 pieces of silver, there's a lot of things Judas could have done with that. Mm-hmm. Is he a person of sin? Sure, but who wasn't? Right, we don't get a diary of everybody else's thoughts in life at that point to know who would and would not do it for 30 pieces of silver. But because he did, and when he felt, whether you call it a rapturous feeling or a feeling of such immense shame because he knew in that moment that Jesus really was God, right, which is the point they hammered home, that he turned around and did what he did. And I sat there and said to myself, why would he be in hell? If you're the God of forgiveness, why would he be in hell? If Jesus died for all our sins, why is Judas in hell? This doesn't make sense. And they were like, well, it's just a story to let you know that, you know, this is what happened with Jesus, and this is the guilt, and this is one of the signs. And I was like, is that a thing that's like hardcore concrete? And they're like, well, no, it's just a parable to do it. And I sat there and said, oh, okay, well, I wonder if I'll ever see this again. I did. In a lot of horror films, this is a thing. The 30 pieces of silver are cursed. They're infernal. Judas sits in hell being tormented, and the devils that torment him seek people out who are greedy, and the 30 pieces of silver are marked that way. The other route is that anyone who turns their back on the cross is considered a descendant of Judas. Mm-hmm. It's considered that atheists are descendants of Judas by some people. And I've heard all sorts, man, that come over about this act, right? And, you know, depending who you are and where you are on that whole religious scale, I was like, okay. When I saw there was a bloodline of them, I could do nothing but grin, right? Because to me, I was like, that's money that was left on the table. Someone needs to tell that story and make it vampiric. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a movie where Judas is Dracula.
Right.
I don't know if you know this, right? It's a very stylized version of, I think it is even called Dracula 3000. And it's like the update of it or whatever, and it's very sensationalized and a little ridiculous, but it follows the story of Dracula. And I think there's even a part in space, I believe, where they're going to open the coffin out there. It was something ridiculous.
Yeah,
and
that was like the ending. I've seen that movie.
So horrible.
Right, but the point is, the part they had cool was that it was all about Judas, and he was going through life, and why he was cursed was because he was pissed at God. Now, who has more of a reason to be pissed at God? Would it be Judas, who didn't know it was Jesus, and he man needed a sandwich, needed to pay rent, and damn it, he wanted to have a life better than the way he had it on the street at that point, and someone said, here's a lot of wealth, here's some life-changing money for you.
Mm-hmm.
Not that necessarily was life-changing for wealthy people, but for him it was. Sure, I'm going to do that. Here he is, and kiss him, I walk away. But then he learned, oh, it's God, and God goes, you would have done that to me? Welcome to your curse. He's like, screw you, man. And that's kind of how it went. And boom, he's a vampire. But what did they do here in the legendary book with that cool-ass potential? What did they make of the Children of Judas?
So in the Children of Judas, the basic storyline is that they appeared because the bloodline comes from the originator, who they called the Hanged Man. And the reason why they call him the Hanged Man was because, lo and behold, this guy was your Belmont character from Castlevania. He was out. He was a no-joke vampire slayer, and he's been doing it for X amount of years. At the end of his road, he hangs up his whip and his sword and his cross. He gets himself a nice family. But lo and behold, as all good stories happen, and the best to us, since we have this in our hands, is he didn't kill a specific vampire, and that vampire was living for this. She had lived, and she was like, well, I escaped death, but my Requiem's really boring without an enemy. So she goes, she finds him, and lo and behold, her Deva heart goes like, wait, he's got a family? No, that's got to go. We can't have that. Slaughters them all, waits until this guy gets back, and he feels the despair. He's not young anymore. He can't go hunting for vampires in this particular case. He's not even sure he could best her. And at that point, the man decides that he's going to go hang himself. A great fighter he was, as they put it in the book, but not a great nooseman. And so he struggles. He doesn't break his neck as he tries to hang himself. He struggles. And his soon-to-be sire looks up and goes like, I need you in my life just as much as you probably need me. Nope, that's not going to happen. Brings him down and embraces him with the sole purpose of saying, I liked what we had before. This toxic relationship where we just get into a fight and you're trying to kill me. I'm going to embrace you, do whatever you have to do, and come find me again. And this is what I want. And in his early Requiem, that's exactly what ended up happening. 20 years go by. They're not even sure whether or not she gave up the ghost or she was just willing to die at that point. But it was a game of cat and mouse. Just to once again prove how twisted the Requiem is and why you exist. Once that's all done, he falls back into despair and he finds the church. And the Lankeus Actum give him purpose. Damned he is, then so be it. And what's interesting about it is he didn't even embrace any new children during that period in time. It was only after he had joined the Lankea that he actually decided, I understand my purpose in life now. And that is, we must teach these mortals X, Y, and Z. I will go ahead and spread forth along that route. And their biggest catch is despair. They, much like, once again, Judas had hung himself, the hangman is the reason why they give him that moniker. But the biggest thing that they do is spread despair. Despair in themselves that they've already had. Despair in others. And you know when at least 2 to 3 start congregating by the amount of mortals that start to die around the area. If only because, once again, they are Deva, and because it's in their bloodline to sate their own lust. For them, they seek out that despair and they want to draw it out the same way you would squeeze a lime to kind of pour it into your tequila. Once you start breaking mortals, you start recognizing what the aftermath of that is.
And to effect here, just add a question. If I got it right, what you're saying is that basically their sole purpose is that they're morbid as it gets, and their ability is to prod victims to towards this despair you're talking about, and that's their point. What do they get for doing that?
Outside of their beast is very happy, I can tell you that at the very least. It's the same type of high that they would normally get from being able to indulge in a vice. That's exactly what it is for them. They've kind of confused the both at this moment in time. That's what makes them dangerous. Much in the same way that the Deva are prone to be into their own types of vices and they indulge into them, their vice is specifically despair because they've drank so deep from that well that they can't help but get it out. And what's weird about it, I shouldn't say weird, let me rephrase it. What's interesting about it ends up being that they're not doing it because they want other people to exit or suffer into despair to the point where they leave, because their nicknames are the Suicide Kings, and we'll get into that for a bit. It's not that they want mortals to kill themselves. They just want to draw that out of mortals. But the byproduct is essentially that. You can't smoke, you can't break some egg, you know, can't make eggs without breaking them. So in that particular fashion, they end up breaking mortals.
But they themselves, when I was reading it, they themselves are suicidal.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So that's it. So it's got to be, because Judas committed suicide, that they have these suicidal impulses. And so it seems like we talked about the beast is, well, it develops this powers, right, based on what it's seeking, right? So if you're something that wallows in despair and that's what's all around you, yet you ever have those people you meet in life that are so suicidal, but they don't do it? Right. You know, you see them, they're very dark, very depressed, very morose, but they never seem to do it. And when you taught them to figure out why, at least for me, I had the benefit of having a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot of friends, but let's say at least, we'll say more than 10, less than 20, right, that seemed to have this vibe. And they identify with, you know, dark clothing, black metal, the whole nine. And folks want to call it a phase. I never called it a phase because I found them to be the most refreshingly witty, sarcastic people who made dark gallows humor kind of a thing. But they didn't really want to kill themselves by admission, right? And that's what this bloodline reminds me of, right? They don't know why they go around to tell you, did you know that every 30 seconds somewhere in the world a woman is raped? Did you know that every 15 seconds, someone takes their own life to suicide? I wonder why this world even exists. Right? These are phrases I've heard from people that I've always been like fascinated by. Mm-hmm. Because it was like, if the world is so dark and you're so dramatic about it, how do you get out of bed? Right? How do you function? How do you make this work? And it turns out, joke's on me. That's why I didn't see a lot of them until nighttime. My bet is because you do a lot of sleeping. Or a lot of reading to learn these facts back in the day. This is pre-smartphone, I could tell you. I guarantee they could tell you a lot about it. And there are all sorts of weird facts. Like, I am in no way making fun of them, but I never figured out. I never cracked that personality quirk as to why it's there. I read this and went, these fucking authors saw the same thing. They had to have met these people who just, that's just kind of a thing, right? Profound poets, more than a few of them, wrote some very good poems where were artists, could draw, could tap into a depth of empathy that I never really understood. I also think this is a hallmark of it as well, that to hit this bloodline well and to truly feel is to understand that, first off, it's a very mature aspect. It's a very mature thing to talk about suicide. There are people in the world who are suffering very badly and have their reasons, and they're very personal. And so when you see this, it's also a risk of a trigger, right? When you read this bloodline, because it could seem like it's almost mocking it, right? It's a vampire bloodline that exists to walk around and prod people to the depths of misery and despair for no seemable purpose. And I wanted to make sure that we landed a purpose, that even if you feel you didn't read one, I know there is one, right? Let's go back to that story about Judas. Judas killed himself from a depth of guilt, right? And I don't think it is. I think Judas, for the first time in his life, felt empathy, a profound empathy. There's a lot that was said to me on that day about the story of Judas as the priest felt. And he said that when you truly care about the story, you're going to realize one day that it's not about Judas's betrayal. It's about Judas for the first time being a real human being, right? Who knows what he felt when he kissed Jesus? But it's assumed there's a bunch of miraculous things for even touching Jesus, that people had visions, that people were cured, that there's all sorts of stuff that happened. It's the source of all life, according to the religion, right? So the assumption is that Judas, for the first time, was put in touch with himself and was forgiven. That's the story here. For all the theft, for all that he had done, for all the people he had sold out, for everything he had done, in an instant, Jesus forgave him and didn't have to say anything. Right in that moment, and he realized just how pitiful it was that 30 pieces of metal were given to him at all, that the life he had, he squandered, and he could have been so much better. And for that depth and realization, and he was hit with that wave of sadness as to what was going to happen to Jesus, and he knew it, that he rushed to him. He truly believed that in that moment, all that he could do is to give the Lord his life, because he had squandered it. And that was the point. And to me, it could be a very depth, beautiful thing that he did that he didn't have to do. Because as we know, there's no way Jesus would want him to do that. But you got to think about it. If you take someone that's hopelessly greedy, that all they see is the world as a taking thing, and that they become very adept of taking from others and setting it up to make sure that their selfish needs are met, what happens when you suddenly birth a conscience in that person and they have to face what they did, right? So enter the children of Judas, right? Much like that story you said, he's a vampire hunter, no one if he could do it. Now he's in a game with this sicko who made him, and he had 100 down, eventually did it or whatever. Now he's in this thing of despair, and he knows that he should die, right? Has to. He was hunting vampires, he is, when he knows he has to die, but he can't. He also knows God's real. That's the other side of this coin that they're not saying. According to this legend, this guy had to know God was real. Because if vampires are real, so too is the curse, and so too it came from somewhere. You have to believe in that, right? It's kind of part and parcel with it. But that's a very complex emotional thing. Now, when you add the fact that it is carried in the blood, this is everything that Bertrand talked before when it says that when you're a bloodline and you can pass on traits through the blood in Requiem. This guy's sadness is so profound that it's drawn to certain people, right? And to these certain people, their empathy calls to them as they see the world for what it is. In my opinion, all those friends I mentioned, like I said, I wasn't making fun of them. I truly feel that they see the world for what it is. and they're trying to find a way. It is a phase for them because they're trying to find a way to be able to ignore just enough to move on in life, to be a hope in life, to have that family or that feel. But if they get embraced in that state, welcome to a new level, as Requiem would say, to their own personal hell, right? As now they're continually going to feel that, and they develop a power where their beast can force this on others. Now, why would you do that? In my opinion, if I were to make a Children of Judas off the top of my head, I simply said, I would inflict those who I feel are total bastards in this world that don't get it, or that I'm trying to make them get it. I don't want them to end their life. I want them to have that Judas moment.
And that goes in line with a lot of Lankea theology, right? They're there for a reason. Lankea aren't just like, oh, let's party because we're damned. It's like we have an unholy duty that actually lines up with what you were saying. They are there to punish those that sin and fall. And they do teach those people that lesson you were talking about, because those are the ones that actually overcome the temptation and thus are, I'm not going to say okay, but now off limits to the rest of Lankea, ostensibly.
I also think that one of the things that this section does very well, as we were talking about, is when we speak from all seriousness and give all due aplomb and respect to the situation as well as the topic of suicide, but it really calls to as well, there's a section here that also speaks to like why they have a mentality of it, right? You can never understand someone's despair of why they take the actions that they do. However, what it does do is it does its best to at least give you reasons why characters want, either mortal or immortal, want to do the actions they do. For example, the most obvious is like, you know, death by self-harm. However, there's also other ones, honor suicide, like seppuku is still suicide, no matter how you see it, right? You don't die for another person unless you want to. Death by cop, you know, medical suicide, addiction, protest suicide, whatever the case is, it talks about how other people get to, or rather, you know, from a character's perspective or a story narrative, it gives you reasons to call, to draw attention to these characters, these interactions are calling to attention something. So I thought that was very well written of how, you know, it brings up those topics.
And by well written, that it discusses it in a mature light. You know, again, right. Requiem does not condone and say that we are making heroes or drawing attention, that this is something to make light of and make a game out of. It's not saying that. What it's saying is that in terms of the vein of horror and personal horror and darkness and bad things and whatnot, despair is a part of that. And you can't discuss despair. If you play Wraith the Oblivion, you can get why there are ghosts and that some of them ghosts got there by not just being murdered and dying of natural causes. Some took their own life and get over it, right? I don't mean that to be mean. I mean that in the sense of let's not make this what it isn't. It's for entertainment purposes. It's in here. And, you know, if you're not a fan of it, skip the Children of Judas. There's still many more in this book, such as the Galoi. Now, I'm going to go over some briefly just because I'm going to tell you that they're attached to. If you're into a myth, I'm going to just hit it out there because we're coming to getting pretty long here and what's going on. Like I said, we can make almost an hour each out of all these talking about it. But the Galoi is a Nosferatu bloodline, and long story short, they do something very weird. They bathe in their own blood, right? If you're fans of Elizabeth Bathory, this is clearly the legend that this comes from, right? They do it in a very cool way. We're talking, there's different powers that can come about from bathing in their own blood period, that make it very cool. Check out that bloodline if you're interested in Elizabeth Bathory to see a different view, a different take for it. The Gulikin, well, they have an amazing sense of smell. This one, I wanted to talk about just about that alone, because you may not think it has anything to do with a vampire at all, but this is actually hyper-focusing on the beast. The aspect of the hedonist. We know sex is good and blah, blah, blah. We know eating is good and blah, blah, blah. Drink and wine, and we've seen all those things, right? The wine specialist, the blood specialist, blah, blah, blah. Scent, though? You ever wonder why scent is attached to memory?
It's never really occurred to me as to why it has. It's just something like I knew of.
Take a minute. Can you remember the first time you smelled blueberry muffins homemade?
No.
Okay. How about fresh baked bread made by your grandmother?
Well, my grandmother really, really liked to smoke a lot in the house. So when I think of her, I think of cigarette smoke.
So, but what I'm trying to trigger for everybody is, other than Brentron's apparently jaded edgelord life, He doesn't get anything like that. So, but I'm trying to bring up a fact that my grandmother did. Right? When I smell blueberry muffins, I want them not because I care this bakery makes them well, but by scent alone, it's like that love is there. It's there in a tin waiting for me. In a big, fat New York blueberry muffin that I had to have when I visited, it had nothing. I paid the $18 for one blueberry muffin, and it was the size of my chest. Right? I don't know why it did. I mean, it was huge. It was huge. And me and a friend split it, and then what we couldn't eat, we gave away to a guy in the street who honestly was giving us directions of where to go to next anyway. There's no way we could eat that. Eat it all. It's too much sugar, and we're all walking. I'm just saying. They don't have exactly porta potties in a cab, so take it easy, right? I'm being humorous. But the point is, when you smell something like that and it triggers a memory, you want it more for the memory. The desire is there for that, let alone than the smell alone. The scent of a lover. A lot of people don't get this, but when you have that special someone in your life, there is few things that get you feeling happy and safe and warm and welcome. It's like you can, when you smell them, you can almost taste their lips, right? It's the senses that they get into it, right? The smell of saffron can do that. Certain smells like patchouli, certain colognes and perfumes are all designed to elicit and play in your mind, right? The fantasy of it. And because of it, that's where this bloodline, I feel, definitely sings home. It's a Deva bloodline. I 100% dig them, mm-hmm. right? Get this idea behind them because of it. Now, they're more in-depth and not exactly 100% that, but they definitely focus on it. And there's vampirism here, too, as well.
What I want to bring up about that, though, is I like the explanation of their clan weakness so much better than I do the Ventrus. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's literally the Ventru of the masquerade bloodline. It's literally they have a refined palate, mm-hmm. and they will do nothing to stop until they get that refined palate. And anything else requires them to willingly be like, fine, I'll settle for less. But considering what they are and considering that scent means everything to them, and they're always looking for that strive of perfection to attain that scent, and them being Deva, it lines up so perfectly well that it's easy to see why that would be the clan weakness for them, or rather their bloodline weakness. I thought that was better written in this case.
Now, my jaded comment, and it's only because there was a player I played with who played a Kufukuji, one of the Hungry. It's a confusing name. It's because mm-hmm. it literally is Kufukuji, right? Kufukuji. Okay, so they played an Order Dracul, right? They got to have the coils to subvert, and then they're playing a bloodline that has a power to help subvert further. Right? That's the combo they wanted. It was like a power game thing to me. Yeah. And when he was telling me that he did it because the Hungry are always battling to keep this back, I'm like, wait a second. But the Kufukuji were literally meant to be sort of a principles meets the focus mind battling the beast.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's the supreme war of humanity where they actually give you a weapon to battle that urge, the beast itself. Why would you turn around? I mean, you could be Order Dracul. There's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't bother me. But isn't the Order Dracul, wouldn't they be wanting the Kufukuji to join them? Because are the Kufukuji not doing the same thing? Are the Hungry not pursuing what they're about? And the answer is probably not. Right.
To go into that, I'd say not, absolutely not at all. The Kufukuji do it from like an ascetic standpoint, right? There's not a religious aspect behind it. It is certainly enlightenment, but it is not the Ordo Dracul's brand of enlightenment. That is we already talked about them in like a whole other podcast before, right? But to sum that up, they are about changing their innate state, not just controlling impulses or desires that well up from behind them. That's a facet of it that's not even in the same, I wouldn't even say in the same direction that the Kufukuji do.
They bring in a bout of Japanese Eastern flair, I should say, to this, even in their artwork. To get the Kufukuji, let me just tell you folks, there's a graphic photo drawn where it shows them basically having like a tea ceremony, except one of the four gentlemen is chained around the neck, frenzied, trying to reach forward and do something. And the mm-hmm. other three calmly observe him, waiting for him to get it in check. Right? So he must be the subordinate, right? The student learning. And the other three are waiting for him to get a hold of himself. And that gives you an idea of what they're about. And I didn't get Order Dracul, but I easily saw why. Because, like, I read this book and went, now I know why that son of a bitch played. Okay. Mm-hmm. Easy mode, right? Big numbers. That's what I saw, and I was, it put a bad, I'm not saying a bad taste in my mouth. He did what he did, but, and he played it well. I want to point that out. He did play it very well from what I read. I felt he was Kufukuji more than Ordo Dracul, but that's kind of my problem, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think your bloodline alone should overshadow what your covenant is. Like, almost like I built, you know, in my head, folks, I'm not saying in everyone's. In my head, it should be your covenant should be the social thing you kind of are a part of, and so people should see those quirks first. But as we get to know you on a personal level, in your haven, in your domain, you're more of your bloodline because you can be more of yourself and kind of hang up that jacket of social standing as you can now be yourself in your Requiem. And that's how I see it.
I agree with that outlook 100% because covenants aren't even really organizations so much as they are philosophies. They're tenets you hold, or they are how vampires spend their Requiem. It is like me and Bob, when we first meet, we might see like whatever profession you had like before podcasting, right? And I would talk to you about like, oh, I'm a software developer. And as we like get to know each other, like we find out more about each other's families, our own quirks, our own hobbies, things beyond that. That makes it in a mundane level. But I do, and I know this isn't bloodline specific, right? But I want to hammer that home because that's a damn good observation about how vampires interact and how they are perceived in the All Night Society or in the Danse Macabre.
And I'm going to let those words stand. I don't think they need to be touched at all. Thank you for pointing that out. The Miscellaneous, this is my favorite in the book. This is my favorite in a lot of games. This won me over for Requiem. I read the Miscellaneous, and I'm going to tell you the tale because I could take the time, and I own the podcast. So, and they're letting me do it, and the editor said he won't cut it down. So here's the deal. The Miscellaneous is, by the way, he gave me the finger point. He actually didn't say that, but he just on camera told me you got it. I was like, okay, cool. So the Miscellaneous, I empower my team, folks, so keep me in check. But the Miscellaneous are basically a Roman bloodline, right? Mm-hmm. At least that's what they say. They're definitely venture-based Roman bloodline where they personify power, right? To quote a good thing about Destiny 2, a Menagerie fan, if you will.
I fucking knew it. I fucking knew it.
With power is what they say in Destiny 2, right? In this alien bloodline, the whole time I'm like, they're the Miscellaneous. I know for a fact Bungie plays Requiem. They have to, right? And you may be wondering why so excited. What I want you to imagine is that you're a Roman senator, and I, Bob, Robert Miscellaneous, right? First of his name, if you will, have invited you out because I'm also one who breeds horses for the Roman Empire, right? That's the conquest, but the Senate needs me. My family knows much wealth, and there are two other families like me, but we're not exactly a part of your political stratagem because we make our own wealth, and accordingly, we don't need to do what you need us, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. But we use you for protection, but more importantly, we're bored, and part of that boredom allows us to use our largesse to do what we want. So part of that is to have these lavish parties. And at these parties, we have the finest of things, the best of dancers, the greatest of entertainers. No wine is as sweet as it is here. There is no mead made that is not delicious here. There are no women as beautiful as what we have at our party because we can afford it. And that's what we do. But most importantly, we have the rarest of foods and the finest of exotic ingredients that are brought to the table ever heard of. And this is when the Miscellaneous were alive. So they point out in the book they would have something like, was it the stomach of a cow, but filled with all manner of dates and olives and specialty foods from around the area? Like, that cow didn't have to get killed.
A baked flamingo tongue.
Right.
Yeah. Just whatever but, crazy imported thing.
Right. But you did
stuff dormice.
But what hit me home, right. But what hit me home about that cow was the fact that could make milk. Mm-hmm. Right, there's dairy to get from it. There's things the cow can do, but yeah, just kill it for the feast. We'll have more. There are more cows. Cattle is not hard to the Miscellaneous. So, but they're interested. They have four stomachs. We want one. What does it taste like? You know, and I don't think it's a stomach. I think they actually said the teat.
It's the udder. Yeah,
the udder. There you go. Yeah, that's what it is. The udder is what it is. Like disturbing parts of animals that are exotic and you never would think to eat it. Right? These guys love chitlins. Right? Mm. They love every aspect of the animal and would consider it great. I know a lot of folks who can't even try. I myself like liver. There are people who'd be like, oh, what the hell? But that's an exotic thing I got used to. My dad liked it. Me too. Like father, like son. At least that's a meal we shared. And every time, though, I brought back to the Miscellaneous. I said, okay, so they're eating this in itself, not that bad, except for kind of makes the vegan point. You know, you didn't have to eat all these weird-ass animals. Mm-hmm. You sick fuck. You could have just, you know, had a burger and called it a day. I mean, come on. Well, we're Roman and rich and we have slaves. How dare you tell Bob Marcellarius what to do? So therefore, I am now going to cook one. What's that? Why not? I haven't tried people long pigs on the menu. Why? Because it's a slave and a dead man and I'm going to have one. It turns out it's pretty decadent. Mm-hmm. Pretty tasty. Nothing quite cooks like human. And that's something could have happened. Maybe they don't know. But what they do know is that these guys, they become vampires. Right? Their money, their wealth, everything they do, that's what it is. But these vampires, because of their moniker gourmand, you can imagine they have peculiar things that happen to them in their requiem. First and foremost, I think vampires, a good vampire clan bloodline is defined by their weaknesses. I adore this one, right? And I'll get into it because I feel it needs to be gotten into. So Marcellarius already, they start by wanting to pick and targeting by culture anyway, large people, folks who clearly know what tasty and good is, right? We don't get you CrossFit weirdos. We don't want you folks who diet at the gym and eat bran muffins and just salad and that's boring. We want people who know what a real smorgasbord is, who understand good BBQ, who enjoy these finer foods in life and thus grow fat with power, right? You have flavor. But then we want to make you a vampire. Well, what does that do to your beast? Well, first off, we're going to add another 150 pounds to you off the bat. As your
flesh.
In a night,
100 pounds, 300 pounds probably over the next two, and that's when you stop for now. Like, that blew my mind.
I loved it, right? So immediately you got to be this big fat person who's now a vampire. Now, why I love this is because it is so taboo. The genius of making this a clan had to come from the same people that I did. That what is the obsession with every freaking vampire having to be a model? Right? Mm-hmm. They're either a model or they're a monster. There's like no... What's going on, right? You know, and then if they're an average person, they're an overlooked person. They're not as... You know, we do that. And then like as human beings, though, we don't really care. We never really broke the topic taboo of, you know, obesity and how, you know, it's a disease. It's killing folks. It's terrible. It's bad. And then you sit there and go, it's not bad for you, Jack. You don't think a person who's obese knows they're obese and they got feelings and stuff like that. And I feel this book here goes, yeah, but look at how the Marcellarius see it. That's the important part. They're not trying to make fun of obesity here. And that's a mistake. I've seen STs try to run the Marcellarius as being this big fat guy. He's Pearl from Blade, sitting in a room and whatever. And I'm always like, are you forgetting the culture and the history that was put into these people? Mm-hmm. No. They are one of the most powerful of the Ventru and the very best of them, one can argue. They're not afraid to use that shrewdness and that power and that wealth they have to get what they want. They're nigh unstoppable, right? Is how they're written and what they seek and what they bring into the clan. Now, their corpulence is a mark of prestige to them. Mm-hmm. Amongst themselves, your jowls will be counted, right? Who knows? They might even pay you based on it. I don't know how that works out, but you could. You can see all sorts of strange culture developing from here because the older the Marcellarius, the more weight they pack on. It's an odd phenomenon, but their discipline helps them actually do some pretty god grotesque things, right? One is, how about eating a person?
Yeah.
Not just eating a...
Waste not, want not.
Right. Hey, if Brentron's blood is good, his meat's got to be just as tasty. And well, I'm going to spend the time...
Like, what is that process when you, like, you put, like, a steak in a bag with, like, all these juices? What is that called? You know what I mean?
Marinating, yep.
Yeah, it's a walking human person is just marinating all their bones and muscle in their blood anyway, so it's gotta be great.
But think of the cool culture things you could do, right? So you go to an impoverished neighborhood, and you bring, like, and you do it like a Roman, right? You're sitting in your limo, and of course it's air-conditioned, you're sitting back, and you're eating your snack of cashews because you can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're going to blow it up, or you're gonna vomit it. That's not a problem. You're saving it in the bowl because your retainer knows what this is about. And what you're going to do is you're about to pay a young man $50,000 to eat your vomit blood cashews. And he's going to eat it all. And when he's done eating it, you're going to dominate him to go home with you. You're not paying him $50,000. But as it turns out, once a month, you meet other Marcellarius. And since he's pre-eating the blood cashew gorget that he just slurped down for you, and the blood's addictive, and the blood of a vampire is even more dangerous, and you got it in the worst of ways, You're smiling as you bring the new delicacy into the home.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what it is. And whether you're going to eat his flesh or just sample his blood, well, that's up to the party. Depends on how hungry your fellow gourmands are and what you're going to end up doing. But just to be sure, you have your retainer take him in the back and hose him off with a hot hose designed for cattle to make sure it removes the first layer of hair and all the, you know what I'm talking about? That hot hose they cruelly do to prep him for. And so this dude gets that first layer of skin off and he's sitting in there screaming and he's waiting for it. And then turns out we just need some of his blood. And so your guy dominates him again. He walks away, but he doesn't have $50,000. He walks away with a house and a car and a contract that says you sign this. If you keep your mouth shut, you'll be paid medical bills in excess and blah, blah, blah. Like a weird, wild, hellish night that Rob Zombie wish he made a movie about, right? Where it didn't go that far, but could have, right? This whole promise. And the whole time, your villain was this obese guy walking around, humming a tune, prepping his house, perfect clothing, you know, Egyptian silks and or Arabic silks and Egyptian cottons he's wearing, tailored to his body, the finest of things everywhere, and this horror that's mixed in. And to me, they're like a walking painting piece, this bloodline, because it mixes both. It's taboo meets excess meets the power of Rome. Then you get to the fact that, well, now that we have all that, the pure raw brutality that is going to be in Vampire, and you don't want to necessarily be in a deal with these guys. You don't know what to expect.
And I like that they take the time to point out, like, oh, by the way, despite all this brutality and this grotesquery that occurs in these hilled manners, they have these very strict set of rules of etiquette that they all follow because none of them could ever dare to break them. They do point out there are different, you know, levels to these, right? But their ranks really only apply when they're hosting a party, and they do not insult any guests or allow themselves to be rude hosts. And they don't see themselves as rude if they eat the guest of honor at the end of the meal, because that's part of it.
Right. There's like eight different like reasons for a feast that they have in there and how they run it. And that was one of my favorite ones. In particular, how if to show proper etiquette, your fork is at 10 and 4 on the plate, your fork and knife, to show that your plate is empty and you are ready for more. Not that you're done. More is coming.
But when you eat the flesh, you're also supposed to force the air up through your lungs to let out this huge belch that fills the room with the aroma of the blood and the flesh you just ate, so that you're showing your appreciation to the cook for a job well done.
The corpse breath, right? You're supposed to chew and slurp and chomp to show the deliciousness of the meal. And this is in like $20,000 suits at a $50,000 table in the finest of finery. And the whole time, there's exotic ghouls that are masters at keeping a rock iron face. Mm-hmm. Can you guess why?
Because they can't be rude. They can't be rude.
You can't make a mistake. You like your limbs? Mm-hmm. Right? You don't want him to look at you and go, I do wonder what your sweetbreads would taste like, rude man.
As he takes a steak knife and carves off a chest from his arm.
He just has to yank it. What are you talking about too, with that strength?
Yeah, but that's rude, like right? You have like, this is not finger food, DJ. All right? It's a spoon, not a shovel.
He's like, listen, I brought fried chicken to the table.
Fried chicken.
It's one of the few things where it's like, you could just hear a statement of, you know, if you're a retainer, I'm going to need a number 4 tonight. Run off and get me a number 4, DJ. Be back for mealtime. I slumber now. But it's nighttime. Like I see them as a vampire that would take naps. Right? His largeness is sitting there and just be, all right, I've sent him off for my meal. And now put on the stock tape from the stock market. I will watch it as I slumber. And then he just nods off to watching his wealth grow. And DJ knows that to get a number 4, he has to somehow pay some poor person to eat a meal, the actual number 4 at McDonald's, whatever it is, but nothing else. And then come back with him somehow so that his master can sample his blood or his flesh or both, right? That this is some of the dark things you can play with or not at all. Might just be your gourmand likes to cook and knows what's good. There's all sorts of things you could do with it, but they're a fun, fun group. But I will tell you why they're cruel. There are pictures in here that show you them. And there's two in here that just, my God, I thought I knew horror. I really did. Mm-hmm. And this kind of put in a map for me. Number one, the guy lounging back in a chair, right? He's wearing like what looks like a Roman undergarment. That's yeah, it.
I thought he was in a spa.
And right. And then his two servants are in there, but his servant's holding up a woman who appears that she's had her limbs decapitated, removed already. And he's just holding them up like you would maybe a menu to show what part he would like to sample next.
Oh, I thought it was a child.
And it could have been a child. See, I looked at that too, and I was like, it's a woman, it's a child, it doesn't matter. Both are horrible.
Yeah, it's true.
It's horrible for both of them. The look on his face, the way he drew it. Oh, man, I feel sorry for those retainers. Like, that's, gut-wrenching. You have to be there for that, right? Then there's one where it shows Amicelarius, who is, like, in the throes of ecstasy frenzy. Like, literally swimming through a person, eating them. And mm-hmm. it's like, you know, it's terrible. And I'm like, okay, this is the crew that I never want to be as a player, but I would love to run as a storyteller, right? That's a thing. But the final piece of them that I think I applauded when I saw it was the guy who invented the grape crusher.
Yeah.
The winemaking machine. Right? So there's a Marcellarius who's credited at getting tired of having to, you know, go through the trouble of getting the delicious blood from the people he likes. So he orders a number four, his retainer brings him back, and he puts him in his contraption. And his contraption closes on one end like a barrel, is by the description. And it has up top this handle that slowly has to be winched down to crush the grapes. We're going to call the human the grapes, and you'll get it, right? Because mm-hmm. how you make wine is you got to crush the grapes. We don't stomp on it anymore, but we use a machine that slowly presses it on down to get every drop out right into the container that you want it in so you can bottle it and age it or whatever you're going to do with it. Well, this one does it for people. And it has a nice contraption where it says most of the fluid goes to one side and the blood is somehow strained into the other. And that's that. But here's the gross part. It doesn't say it removes the urine or the internal body fluid of waste or none of that or the bile. So how could it? Right? If it's going to get the blood, it's going to get that too. And he makes no attempt to sift it. And this goes in the container. And this guy just goes, what an alarmingly tasty bouquet. I smell asparagus as well as a lot of iron this time around. This man was he's clearly some sort of athlete you put in here. My lord, I got him from a gym. Ah, perfect. That means there's pre-workout in this too. I might actually sweat. Oh, I can't wait to try this. And he's sipping it down. And I sat there going, you know, anyone who's had ate asparagus and peed knows that smell. Mm. Now, on top of the fact that blood can have that coppery scent, and if you've ever tasted your own blood in your mouth, you don't want to taste your pee. Right? I don't know what that tastes like, and I don't want to, but we've had asparagus, and I'm sitting here going, ha, ha. And this dude's sitting here with this in like a wine glass or a snifter or whatever. Just, you have to roll it around and get the aroma. Are you going to be okay? Should I make you more comfortable? You know, it's horrific. Bravo is what I say. But I digress. I promised I wasn't kill time on it, and I did that. Thank you for letting me indulge. Mm-hmm. We wanted to do this for every one of them, but there's some we're going to talk about in depth and others that we're just going to have to leave to mystery because there's a decent amount in here, but not quite enough to split in a podcast because basically they're bloodlines, right? It's designed for you to get this, to check it out. But if you haven't caught on, we were literally breaking it down how each of them has some fitting story that fits in the legend or at least the wheelhouse of vampires in some capacity. And each and every one of them does, even the Marcellarius story, right? That gluttony, that taste of blood, that Romanesque power play, that's all it's all there. So that being said, we know it's a great book. I know we enjoyed it. But just got any parting comments, you two, before we get to going here.
Other than one of the bloodlines that comes after this, but the Melisidae, they are not one that I've ever played as a character, not had a real interest as playing as a character, but love as a storyteller because this is a bloodline that makes a great antagonist or could make a great antagonist. This can go a couple of different ways. And I'm actually kind of glad we're not going in depth about this because I think I'd enjoy people reading about it themselves. That's a candy I don't want to spoil.
We will for that. And I did think of something. Okay. I forgot the players bloodline, literally called the players. Yeah. Well, I think the company is poking fun at itself.
Yeah, it is.
Right? That's what I felt. Self-awareness. It's a bloodline of kindred actively upholds the pop culture aspect of vampires. I really felt that's all of us. right? Every single one of us, right? And it points out the shallowness of bloodlines and the story depth that it could get into. But the fact is that they're held to the whim of what people believe vampires are supposed to be at the time.
Weirdly, they kind of help protect the masquerade in an ironic fashion.
I actually adore this because I kept sitting here going, Twilight!
Yeah, Twilight! That's what it was.
And you could totally do it, and I think it could be amazing to see. Check them out. Check them both out. I agree with you. They're good enough to talk about, but you know, only we're trying to hold to a time here.
Yeah.
So, DJ.
I think for me, what I thought was really good about this book is the legendary, I think, was a double entendre on that because they mentioned, of course, it doesn't mean it's badass, but what I think definitely was the legends of certain things. Everywhere, even from the Braum, right? The fact of questing knights, etc. You feel that in there, even Children of Judas. I think they all have things that are just staple ideas that you didn't get to see in a clan, but you get to see in the Bloodline. I felt it more in this book than I did in The Hidden. I thought that was very well done. It could also be because, you know, having the additional data in there, that additional 50% more chunk, to story also helped out. So
that's an interesting point that you know works and feed forward there. That constructive criticism and doing well. I distinctly feel that I think they did follow a guided theme and it mentioned it in there. You know, it wasn't like I had fantastic insight. I want to see if you caught it as they wrote it. That's always my test. I like to read what they say. This book does, and I like to see if you guys think they hit it because often you tend to not mention whether you focus on what's in the book, not necessarily what they intended. And that's the test there. Each and every one of these stories was pulled from legends. That's kind of the theme and the point of the book. So that's there. They did add more content. I think I agree with you 100%, DJ, that it did better to help out. I'd rather have less to have more than slam me with a bunch of stuff where I have to make it all up. You know, that's me. So I think that's a very good thing. But thank you, guys. I always have a blast with you talking Requiem and going through the books and enjoying that a little more. I hope you guys got some insight into getting another book out of your collection here. Go out and get it, especially if you're just getting back into Requiem. I find players love more options, and storytellers would love more to go with than the basic ones they have in the clan book. This helps you expand that knowledge and add some real creep depth and entertainment to stuff your players aren't going to go, I know what that is. who likes that when you're a storyteller, right? So some do, I guess. I got to add that, but I don't believe it. So thanks, everybody. We'll catch you next time, and thank you.
Thank you for listening to our 25 years of Vampire the Masquerade podcast. If you liked what you heard, please reach out and let us know on Twitter at 25 years of VTM, at our email, info@25yearsvtm.com, on Facebook at www.facebook.com/25yearsvtm, or on our website, www.25yearsvtm.com. If you would like to support us, we can be found at patreon.com/25yearsofvampirethemasquerade.